So here we are in this post Article 50 submission world. How does it feel, guys?
Sorry, Mike, I can't hear you from the other side of Article 50.
I'm sorry, but the your protocols... Audio...
your audio immigration's been blocked.
How quickly things happen.
I think I might move to Germany, Mike.
Okay. Yeah. I'm thinking of getting a pool table, so yeah, you're welcome to come round. But anyway, seeing as Andrew isn't here for some reason, then I will assume control of the podcast. This is the Linux Voice Podcast, Season 5, Episode 5. I'm Mike Saunders.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison. When's the last... Didn't you used to do the intro, Mike? A long, long time ago.
Oh, back when it had a completely different name.
Yeah. It started off with Paul, didn't it?
It started off with Paul's contrary to popular...
Oh, yeah.
Demands? No, not demands.
Wishes?
Ideas. Wishes, yeah. Or something like that. I think we've all had a stab at presenting the podcast at some point. Maybe we need to just distribute it randomly in the future.
Yeah. I've never done an intro.
You've never... Oh. All right, next episode. Next episode, it's a Ben special.
I don't know if I can take the pressure of an intro.
Well, I can give you a training course for a low, low price of €200 a day. Or pounds. Well, I don't know how much pound is worth. Yeah.
Pounds worth nothing.
Foreigners coming here and taking our intros.
Well, pound. There's even a new pound.
Oh, there is. Everything. Have you seen one yet?
No. I don't. I so seldom go outside the house now. I'm scared. It's Brexit summertime.
What's the difference? What's so cool about the new pound?
It's got 12 sides.
Whoa! Well, that's is not... that like to make it hot? Harder to forge or something?
I guess I've no idea. I think part of it's to help blind people. It's easy to identify, maybe. Because I can't imagine the thing stopping forgers is their inability to cut 12 sides.
That's a good point. And I wonder if it helps if you're flipping a coin in the air. I wonder if it makes it more likely to land perfectly on an edge, which always looks cool.
You say
it always adds an extra bit of... Yeah.
You know, Has it ever happened to you?
No. I've only ever observed other people doing it.
But in the multiverse, one version of Mike has flipped a coin and it's landed on its edge.
So, that's true. That guy sounds pretty cool now when I think about it.
All my dreams are in the multiverse now.
But to be fair, in the multiverse, one version of Mike has also flipped a euro and it's landed exactly on its edge.
I might try it now, actually. But beforehand, I'll organise this podcast. So, yeah, Season 5, Episode 5. I'm Mike Saunders.
We've done that, Mike.
Oh, did we? Oh, yeah. It all seems so long ago. Anyway, yeah, so in this awesome Linux-packed and free software-packed episode, we have news, we have our finds, and the finds from our ISC channel. We probably don't have any neurons, but we definitely have an awesome voice of the masses. Of course, if you like what we do and you like this podcast and you like listening to us, then you can read things that we have written in the Linux Voice section of Linux Magazine. Go to linuxmagazine.com and subscribe and read all the awesome stuff we write and pay for our beers. So I think, first of all, let's go over to our news correspondent in Bristol, Ben Everard.
Hello from Bristol. Right, it's been a fun-packed fortnight, both in and out of the Linux world. And by fun, we mean terrifying. So, first up in this fortnight's terrifying array of news, the British and American governments are vying with each other to see who can strip away the most freedoms. It's really two items of news, but it's too depressing to talk about twice. So let's bang them both together here. Across the pond in America, the Senate, Congress, government thing, I don't know, what do they have? Not the House of Commons, but like that. They've voted to allow ISPs to sell all your data and to advertising companies and anyone else who comes along and generally just completely ignore any right to privacy you once thought you had.
Yeah, but it's putting America first, isn't it? This is all about business and making America a success again.
Well, I don't think we quite know yet whether or not it's about putting America first, because as we record this, Trump has yet to sign it. Oh. So we don't know which side of the make America great aspect this falls. Over here in Britain, our Supreme Home Secretary, Amber Rudd, has decided that end-to-end encryption is all sorts of awful because maybe some people might talk about things that she doesn't like.
I know. I mean, this was, I think, the day after the attack in London.
Yeah, and there's a few parts to this because, yeah, she said that, you know, WhatsApp is a safe space for terrorists, whatever. But presumably the government have his phone. Now he was killed in the attack. That phone is within the hands of the authorities, so it's not end-to-end encryption that's stopping them get it. They have one of the ends.
Yeah,
it's other things.
I noticed the news around the time, or a few days later, and it said the attacker, his phone had connected to WhatsApp 2 minutes before the incident. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean he was communicating on WhatsApp. It just sounds like he was doing this on his own. But of course, your phone will connect to WhatsApp. It will send pings back to WhatsApp and Telegram and anything else. That doesn't mean he was using that for terrorist purposes. Now, if he was, then yeah, that has to be part of the debate. But that kind of news is just rubbish. Oh, yeah. His phone connected to WhatsApp. His phone was connecting to a cell tower as well. It's just what they do.
I mean, I thought before the podcast started, I wondered whether we should talk about this. I feel quite uncomfortable talking about what is a tragic incident that injured and killed and affected so many people's lives. But politicians are often the first to use events like these to put up some kind of straw man argument for something that I strongly believe would be a mistake. And, you know, and I suppose that's how we have to respond to it. We've talked about this so many times over the last 8 years, and it's difficult to, you don't want to bang on about the same old things, but in an ideal, perfect world where we could, trust the implementation of the government, it's not really the government, you know, it just, then it would be acceptable, but the world will never be like that. And it's unacceptable. And it's the way the internet and security works. And it's the way the world worked for a long time, you know, close the curtains, you know, it's not going to stop terrorists. It's only going to create more risk for us ordinary people who aren't doing anything wrong and obviously don't have anything to hide except, you know, our pride and our humility.
Yeah, but it's like you say, lots of people will say in response to this, well, I've got nothing to hide. And you mean, well, you got nothing to hide from the current government, which is, you know, reasonably benign as far as the world goes. But what if all this information is being stored and absolute crazy parties get in 10, 20, 30 years and they come after you because you looked at that?
Yeah.
I don't know. But something on Wikipedia once.
But who's to trust the government? I mean, nothing to do with whether the government's good or bad, but the government doesn't have a great track record on building secure IT systems. And it's, you know, and it would only take an Edward Snowden like leak, which may be done for the right reasons, to open wide, you know, our entire lives effectively. And I'd much rather take direct responsibility for my own privacy and my own security and make my own mistakes than have to then trust yet another third party in what is becoming this huge chain of people I'm entrusting my character to.
I mean, I don't really follow what's going on in the UK, but are they saying they want to have backdoors again, backdoors to encryption, which we all know would be completely ineffective and just let random ass crackers get in?
As always, there's no details of what they want, just hand wavering and how important it is. I mean, for me, it's the fact that there isn't really a choice here about our trust in the government, blah, blah, blah. You either have strong encryption or you don't. You don't say, oh, I have strong encryption, but not for this and not for this and not for this. That's not how it works. It's binary. It's there or it's not.
Atomic.
Should we move on to some happier news?
Yes, please.
So, happy news this fortnight comes from Stack Overflow, which does a yearly survey about lots of things, really, but mostly surveying developers and anyone who's written code, probably copied most of it from Stack Overflow, if they're anything like me. And they've concluded that 26% of developers worldwide are using Linux as a desktop. Which,
yeah, 26%.
You know something, this doesn't surprise me.
It doesn't surprise me.
And I was just going to say, I think it's to do with the rise of the terminal. Because now I do nearly everything in the terminal with Tmux. And really, there's only one operating system I want to use the terminal and Tmux on, and it's Linux.
Yeah, I think it started with macOS when they, because obviously OSX has the terminal and that, and it's sort of, people start to use it. But it's always been a little, I've always felt it's been a bit crippled, the macOS terminal. It's not.
Yeah, it's difficult to get new versions of Python and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's not sort of a core part of the system in the same way it is with Linux. So just to go give you a little bit of context, the 26% using Linux compares to 22% last year, and up from, I wrote down what it was in 2013 and then forgot, it was about 19% in 20, it'd been increased by about 1% a year, and then suddenly a big spurt last year. The big loser in this has been OSX, which has dropped from 22% last year down to a measly 15% this year.
That's, I wonder how much of this is to do with the new MacBook Pros, or, you know, a lot of people being dissatisfied with them. Some people love them. I mean, you know, a lot of it's a matter of opinion, but you look on Hacker News, you look on Reddit, and you see a lot of people who are like, you know, kind of free and open source software, but like Macs as well, because they're shiny and quite well built and a bit Unixy. And so many people are unhappy with the current lineup. So maybe they've just got a nice ThinkPad Carbon X1, put Linux on it. And yeah, if you're spending all day in a terminal in Tmux, and maybe you just need a web browser for documentation, then you're sorted.
Yeah, I think it's been harder and harder to justify the price of a MacBook as well. The competition's been really catching up to them, not just in terms of sort of performance and that sort of thing, but just sort of the build quality in there. You can get some really nice laptops now that aren't MacBooks.
Yeah, and quite thin ones as well. Can you, you've sent around the podcast notes before. We are actually sometimes prepared listeners. And so what were the statistics for Linux, Mac, and Windows again, please, Ben?
It's 26% on Linux, 32% on Windows, 15% on OSX, and miscellaneous people on other systems.
Yeah, but I wonder what those other systems are. I mean, you know, on the desktop, anything outside of Linux, macOS, and Windows is probably like 0.1%. You know, some dudes rocking FreeBSD and Haiku.
But no, it include a lot of Android. It did have the statistics. I just haven't written them down. I'm not sure.
Oh, okay. But you wouldn't really develop on an Android device, would you?
No, it was a little bit of an ambiguous question, to be honest. Well, actually, I haven't seen they've taken down the survey, as far as I could tell. They only had the results, which didn't have the question in it.
Still, great, good news for Linux.
Yeah, and in the same survey, they asked people about their favorite thing, like their favorite language and their most hated language, blah, 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 blah. And the Linux desktop was the most loved platform.
Hmm. Well, which desktop? I mean, GNOME, KDE, XFCE, Mac-like virtual window manager, AMI WM, CWM, TWM, Window Maker.
You'll have to set up your own survey, Mike. Yeah, I mean, this is, I think it doesn't surprise me, because sort of being around developers and whatnot, you do see a lot of Linux installs these days, but it's still heartening to see that it's not just my biased perceptions.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know why it's taken a long time. I don't know, maybe it's a phase I'm going through, like a minimalist, I don't want the distraction. But, and admittedly I use to do this within KDE, but I just love the command line. I've always used it for things that it was quickest for, you know, kind of file management and scripting and stuff like that. But I don't know, there's something about kind of teaching yourself. It's a bit like teaching yourself the Rubik's Cube while you're doing your work. It doesn't make you less productive, and you're actually learning other stuff at the same time. I've really got hooked on it.
There's something really satisfying about a really long command sort of chained together, slightly obscure, and it just does something. It's not, because you've essentially written a program to do a job, but it kind of feels better than that. I haven't written a program. It's just one command.
Yeah.
Despite the fact it's about 20 commands piped together.
There was this, there's this website, bash.org, which is a home of where people post quips and jokes from IRC channels. And there was one guy years ago, and he's like saying, well, you only need like three commands to install Gentoo. It's just like fdisk devsda ampersand install xyz ampersand, and you know, you can just join probably hundreds, thousands of commands together to make one command. But yeah, you can install Gentoo in three commands if you do all this.
Yeah, no, that's great news.
Right, on to next item of news, a penultimate item of news this fortnight. And that is that Microsoft Office 365, which is their web platform, cloud thingy, what's it, was rubbish on Linux, but now apparently is better. And this is, it's been going around for a while, basically. People notice that if you try to access stuff from your Linux web browser, it's really slow. If you try to use a Windows web browser on the same network connection, it's quite quick. And even if you change the user agent on a Linux web browser, so it appeared to be a Windows web browser, it was really quick. So it was doing some gubbins in the background to, so people have speculated, deliberately slow down Linux.
But surely Microsoft is good now, you know, a member of the Linux Foundation. It wouldn't do that, surely.
Surely not. We couldn't possibly speculate. One of the developers popped up on Hacker News to say it was an honest mistake, Governor. It's all fixed now. And it was to do with the way it was caching things in the background.
I wonder what it was, how they were using this secret cache that identified that somebody was using Linux, and what other things they do with that data.
it's just to help you download stuff. Nothing to see here. Move along, please.
That's right. Don't send all those. Don't send the 99% of the other packets we send to the other users. Those Linux guys might take a look.
Right. And, apparently the problem should now be fixed. Carry on as you were. A final item of news this fortnight is that Nextcloud, the sort of own cloud replacement thingy for creating your own Office 365 alike that doesn't slow people down on Linux, that organization has been scanning the web for instances of OwnCloud and Nextcloud, OwnCloud is the original project from which Nextcloud is forked. Been scanning the web looking for old installs of this that they claim are insecure, and then sending emails to the abuse address linked to the IP, telling people that they need to upgrade.
I wonder who at Nextcloud thought this was a good idea.
I'm genuinely in two minds about this, because part of me thinks that's pretty horrible, and part of me thinks, you know what, the insecure stuff on the web is genuinely a huge problem. You know, these servers are likely to be hijacked, they're being used to attack other people. It's not just your own data that's at risk, it's the general security of the web. And with each passing year, we get more and more powerful botnets being created from these things. And somebody has to take responsibility for something, otherwise the web's going to fall apart in a few years.
But as the operators of those sites have neglected to update their own cloud installations because they neglect it. They don't care. So that's only going to affect people who it's spam. You know, if this was a problem, then it needs a kind of an industry-wide mailing list if they agree that this is. I think it's bad that Nextcloud did this because the problem is it just stinks of them emailing people using software prior to their fork. And I'm a huge fan of Nextcloud. I think generally they've done everything right and they're doing it for the right reasons. I think it's brilliant. I've got it installed on my own server. But this to me it's just slightly below the belt. It's like, you know, leaving a magazine and then giving people a link to how to unsubscribe from your from that magazine, you know, if you create a competitor.
Yeah, I can completely see that, but there isn't a good solution to this. And I think it is a problem that needs a solution. And yes, this is an imperfect solution. Yes, maybe you could speculate that there's an ulterior motive for it, but that doesn't change the fact that it's an important thing that needed to be done. Well, it's an important issue that needs to be solved in some way, and at least they're trying a solution.
Well, if their solution had been to provide an own cloud instructions for updating own cloud with own cloud packages, that I might agree.
Yeah, I can see that point of view.
We should mention one more thing. I don't know if you're going to move on or not. But Joe Ressington's been in touch.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think when we recorded the previous podcast, it was before we'd agreed to do Foz Talk Live, or before we'd all finally confirmed that we'd do it, which was very lax of us not getting back to Joe to say that we could do it. And we did, Andrew included. So Foz Talk Live, we did it last year. Unfortunately, it's just not feasible for Mike to come back from Germany, although I'm sure he'd love to. It's happening on the 24th of June 2017 at the Harrison Pub, which is exactly the same pub as last year. It's a tiny venue in the cellar, close to King's Cross Station, in the middle of London. It goes from 6 p.m. until the pub closes, basically. It's not kid-friendly, but we the three of us had a fantastic time last year, and we're going to go back and try and do the same thing again. Maybe not break that pint that I did at the very beginning and had to sweep it up right in the middle of Joe Ressington's podcast. But yes, we mustn't forget to mention this because Joe will be even angrier with us than he already is. Foz Talk Live 2017, 24th of June 2017. I think there are still tickets left.
I just had a look on their website. It looks like there are tickets left. But I think they're going fast.
Yes. Yes. Because it's a tiny place, but it's cozy.
an attempt to not drink so much, I cycle down a flight of stairs.
Oh, yeah.
This time.
Ben and I both got the last train back, and we both. Well, yeah. I mean, my cycle route is completely off-road, so I'd only be killing myself.
So is mine, too. But mine's about 99% off-road, and I just didn't notice a flight of stairs until I was down them. But to be fair, I did stay upright.
Yeah, yeah. That's it. That's all I wanted to say.
Right, on with the show.
Right, and so it's Finds of the Fortnight. I actually asked the IRC channel a couple of hours ago, and I don't know whether we're recording this on the Wednesday. It's the day that Article 50 has been triggered to emancipate the United Kingdom from the shackles of the European Union, and the Linux Voice IRC channel has been exactly the same. There's no escape or respite from the people that, you know, have been so affected by what's happened. And so I think that has in some way incapacitated people from thinking to the future and finding fines to find.
Is this a really long-winded way of saying there aren't many fines?
No, there's actually been like 200 comments since I put this thing up, since I said. Blimey. But it's mostly tempered by links to Prime Minister's statements and analyses of the letter that was sent to The Hague today. And there are a few. Zed Moylan Pie says the Midori browser. I think that was in response to somebody else saying Quipzilla. They've discovered Quipzilla. That was MTBU. Both great alternative browsers. I've used them. I've used Qt Browser, which I keep giving a plug for. It's brilliant. Also, Vivaldi. I've not used that for ages.
That's the new one from the former Opera guys, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
I haven't used Brave either, which is...
I still use Brave on my phone, actually.
Ah, and is it all right?
But on the phone, it's quite weird. And this is because they didn't develop it from scratch. They bought out a company that had already done it. And it's a bit strange. So when you click on a link, so if you're in, I don't know, another app and you hit a link, it doesn't open your web browser straight away. It opens like a little circly thing and loads the page in the background. And when the page is loaded, it sort of flashes up so you can switch to it.
Right.
So you don't spend ages looking at a website waiting for it to load, which is quite nice, but it's not sort of the main feature of the browser, really. But it does work well.
Wasn't one of the features that it allowed people to pay for like content that is just freely accessible in some way?
Well, I'm not actually sure if they ever implemented right. that. It was no. going to be. You had the ability to basically block ads and in place send Bitcoin to the people who owned the websites.
Right, yeah.
But certainly last time I used it, that was still awaiting to be developed.
I thought that was the main selling point of the browser.
Well, arguably the main selling point was your ability to block ads, which was there from day one. It was sort of built with an ad blocker in from the ground up.
Yeah, but that's not hard to do, is it, in Firefox? You block or whatever. It's like 20-second job and a few clicks.
It kind of depends who you are. It's a 20-second job for you. It's a big job for my mum.
True.
But then installing a browser is quite a big job for my mum.
Okay, I've seen another fine in between Ian Gogo talking about the Prime Minister's statement and Dave talking about Prelude to the EEA, and that's from Rachel Limit. Here's a find that piggybacks on from one of the last podcast, Matrix, the kind of chat communication platform. Not only provide an awesome secure Slack and Signal replacement using Floss and Federation, it lets you have uninterrupted access to IRC channels without having to log them yourself. That's a really cool feature. I didn't know it did that.
That does sound cool. I haven't come across Matrix before.
I think it's matrix.org.
Okay. Have a look.
Dave says something about Schengen, Norway, Switzerland, Norway, solid websites, blah, blah, blah. I think that's about as productive. Norway is rich because, all right, okay. So there are the finds from, somebody emailed me one, so I'm going to mention that. This is from Omniferous Implementer. So I think this is because their children, their children use free Wi-Fi in places like McDonald's and they want some way of securing their connections. And the discovery is, PIVPN.io, PIVPN.io. They've done an amazing job. It's a lot like Pi-hole. A single curl command entered into the command prompt, downloads all the packages, alters your firewall rules, configures everything, and it was easy to set up. So I guess it creates a tunnel to your Raspberry Pi that you can use from outside of your own network that brings you back into your own network from an insecure connection, which sounds...
Unless the insecure network intercepts that package and changes it before you set it up.
I've noticed that there are quite a lot of the thing like Pi Hole as well. To install it, you just copy and paste a code command from the website. But I'm not sure if we should be encouraging people to do that. That's what got Windows, well, apart from many other things. But, you know, people just double-clicking random exes. If we tell people to copy and paste commands, especially putting sudo in front of them, from the internet, well, any Linux box can be totally owned.
That's a very good warning there from Uncle Mike. So there,
I've seen it all. I'm so jaded. I only use like OpenBSD on a VAX.
So there, the finds from the community, I guess. Does anyone else want to share a find?
Can I have a go?
Of course you can, Mike.
I've found out there's a new version of Street Fighter 2 coming out.
Really?
You mean Street Fighter 3?
No, Street Fighter 2.
Is it Street Fighter 2 Theta?
Street Fighter 2 came out for in the arcades in, I think, 1990, 1991. and then on the Super Nintendo at the time. Now, Capcom tried to make updated Street Fighter 3. It does exist, Ben. I think it came out in like 94 or 95, but it wasn't very good. Nobody wanted it. So they made Street Fighter 2 Champion Edition, Street Fighter 2 Turbo Hyper Fighting, Super Street Fighter 2 The New Challengers, Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo, Super Street Fighter 2 X Grandmaster Challenge, Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo Revival, Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo HD Remix, Hyper Street Fighter 2 The Anniversary Edition.
So really, now, the news should be when they ever stop making Street Fighter 2.
Yeah, then there was a bit of a gap, but from May onwards for the new Nintendo Switch, there's going to be Ultra Street Fighter 2, The Final Challengers. So that's it. This has got to be the last Street Fighter 2 game with a name like that. I just find it baffling. I pay no attention to beat 'em up games, but yeah, how much they're milking that franchise.
Have you got a Switch, probably, Mike?
No, I haven't yet. I mean, I would only be buying it for one game, for Breath of the Wild.
Oh, really? Yeah, of course, Breath of the Wild, yeah.
It looks fantastic. It looks brilliant. But there have been some sort of complaints about build quality on the early units with, like, the machine scratching when you put it in its dock. Are you going to get one, Graham?
I'm kind of in the same boat as you. I don't have that much time for games. They're still like an important part of my life, but I can afford to kind of delay them for 6 months, where it's usually an awful lot cheaper and a lot easier to get into. Yeah. And I think I'll probably do the same with that. I've got like a list of 5 or 10 games I really must finish. And as much as I'd love to play the latest Zelda, I never finished Mario Galaxy 2. You know, I should really go back and finish that.
Yeah, no, I'm the same. I should finish Twilight Princess, which I only started playing 10 years ago. You know, I'll get around to that at some point. But yeah, I think Breath of the Wild looks incredible, beautiful, creative. But I know it would either just eat up time, or I'd end up putting it aside and thinking, well, that was £300 or euros. My next find is probably slightly more useful, is MS Outlook It. And this is a website that you bring up in your browser, and if you make it full screen, it looks like you're running Outlook, albeit quite an old version of Microsoft Outlook. It looks like Windows XP. But inside this mock-up Outlook window, you can browse Reddit inside virtual emails. So you can click on email subject lines down the left and add different subreddits. So I like do. I don't have to do this because I work from home some of the time, but I can put you can put SpaceX on the left, and it looks like a mail from like Mr. T. Smith regarding SpaceX, and you click it, and then you can browse the different mails in the conversation. There are actually discussions in Reddit. Like I say, I think it's quite old because it's got some rendering issues, and it looks like it was made for Windows XP or something. But I love the idea. I love that you could be in a busy workplace and your boss is coming around, and you look like you're really churning through your big pile of email when you're actually lolling at kittens and trolling people about expendable rocket launchers and so forth.
So is this just another way for you to talk about SpaceX or spend your day looking at SpaceX stuff?
When I'm not looking at SpaceX stuff, then I do talk about SpaceX, yeah. I was even speaking to my students about SpaceX recently, and I was teaching an English lesson, but I think it's got to stop. The final find is actually from someone else. A guy called Brian Masney emailed it to me, and it's a series of YouTube videos. We'll put them in the podcast notes, but it's a series of YouTube videos where somebody makes their own 8-bit computer from scratch with a big breadboard and wires and LEDs, and he does all sorts of cool stuff like bringing the clock speed down so you can just step through each instruction one at a time to show how it works. And it's a bit like Breath of the Wild, Graham. It's like one of those projects I would love to do at some point. It would satisfy all the geekiness in me. But I just know I'd end up doing nothing else. But it does look awesome. So, yeah, check out the videos. They're well worth watching.
Yeah, there's quite a few people have built 8-bit computers, and there's some great blog posts and stuff on it. But I haven't seen a video before.
Yeah, it's just geektastic, this. It makes me want to do it, but I've got to resist.
Awesome finds, Mike. Thank you.
Can I go now?
Yeah, go for it.
I'm quite disappointed. I was hoping to be able to say I'd done this, but it ended up taking longer than I was expecting, and I haven't actually finished yet. Probably in the next few days we'll get it done. And this is something I'm doing at work, actually. Essentially, we're doing text processing on websites. It's come down to we're searching, doing regex searches of web pages, finding which ones match, et cetera, et cetera. And obviously we want to scale up and do this sort of quite a lot. And so the question has come up, is it possible to run a regular expression across the entire web? And that's what we've been trying to do. And it turns out it's actually not as hard as you might think it is.
You mean like using the internet as like a database?
Basically, every website, pick out the web pages that match a regular expression.
Right, right.
There's a whole bunch of regular expressions we need to run, and we want to find out which ones match which one. So it's sort of like an Uber Google. And so we can't we're not going to quite do it on the whole web. There's something called the Common Crawl database or Common Crawl dataset, which is a load of people, sort of an organization, a public service organization that crawls the web. And they get, to be fair, quite a lot of the web. They got about less than 3.5 billion web pages, which is everything from the Alexa top 2 million websites 2 clicks in. So you go to any of the top 2 million websites, click on any link twice, they've got that page. and a whole load of other stuff as well. So then that comes out to, they do it every month, and each we need to actually process it historically as well, but each month comes out to about 0.25 petabyte of data. Which is...
Is that just text or...
That's just text.
Oh,
including
wow.
HTTP headers and stuff, but yeah, that's only text.
Man.
So... Obviously, that's quite a bit of data to sort of deal with.
The internet is just, it's terrifying, isn't it? What's been unleashed upon the world? This terrible behemoth. Hold on, I've got an idea. Let me share it.
Yeah. Well, technically, the internet's like twice that, because also people put this link on the web, this data set on the website. but anyway, yeah, so we've got this 250 terabyte chunk of data and we need to process it. And we're sort of looking at what we can do, how we need to structure our data center, yada, yada, yada. Turns out we're going down the cloud route. So Amazon have got this thing called EMR, Elastic MapReduce, which allows you to almost instantaneously spin up a Hadoop cluster from scratch, churn your data away, and then shut it down. And you only charge for the time it's being used. And the Common Crawl dataset is itself hosted on Amazon's cloud. So you don't even need to download the 250 terabytes. It's there waiting for you. So you can spin up Hadoop, churn through 250 terabytes, shut down your cluster. And our aim is to process the whole lot in about an hour or two by spinning up a few really powerful servers, well, quite a lot of quite powerful servers in a Hadoop cluster. And just beasting through
and gripping
250
them.
Terabytes. On technically, it's a we're actually using Python. It's Python regular expression, or a whole chunk of them. And then, yeah, pulling out the data we want and just turning the machines off. And we found Yelp have done this. It's one of the ways they extract phone numbers. And they managed to extract all the phone numbers from this on Amazon for $10, $10.70.
What?
Are you giving away trade secrets by talking about this, Ben?
Probably. All right, no one listens.
It makes me want to try it, though. It makes me want to try it.
Yeah, it's been a little awkward to set up, but we've got the sort of prototype working now. And yeah, we'll see if we can get it cranking out in the next few days.
I mean, people must run kind of... They must do. I'm sorry. I mean, I'm completely ignorant. This is what Google does, is run analytics against that data set, you know, or kind of generate, use that to generate neural networks and then try and correlate those, any changes against kind of world events or stock prices or, you know, the next hit by, I don't know, name some big artist. I don't know. It's just, the answer must be in there.
That's exactly what we're doing. And to go into more detail would be giving away trade secrets. But, yeah.
Well, that sounds really interesting. Sounds really... Are there any jobs at your place? There
probably are, actually.
Cool, thanks. Shall I have a go? My first news is that I've got the my Amiga 4000 graphics card working.
Yay!
Yeah, this isn't the new one that I've spent money on, which hasn't arrived yet. although there's a really great update on that, in that the guy that, I'm sorry, I couldn't remember his name the first time, but he's created another small circuit board that connects to the original that works as a pass through or something like an upsampler for the native video signal coming out of the Amiga. So with this graphics, it's like what a ScanDoubler used to do, although it's not taking the analog signal and doubling the frequencies. It's grabbing the raw digital output from the CPU, I think, or whatever's delivered over the Zorro bus, and merging that in with the signal that's being sent to HDMI or DVI, so that you can see all those old screen modes, which you usually had to use like a ScanDoubler or a monitor with loads of frequencies, and you can get that on your late. So yeah, that's considering the price of these old graphics cards is like a lot of money. This is, I think, it's a really great solution for people who still use their Amigas. But for my CyberVision 64, this is like a good moment for me, because I've got a load of old synths that I've tried to fix to varying degrees of success in the past, and it's awful trying to find problems with circuits, printed circuit boards. But this is the one time I've kind of looked at a circuit board, identified what I thought was a problem just by checking continuity on the circuits, and then patched it with a very crude bit of soldering, and then the whole thing worked. It was awesome. I plugged it back into the Zorro slot, and my CyberVision 64 card came up, which is really cool. Really happy with the Amiga at the moment. It's running. It's in the corner. I have to turn.
Have you got it connected to the internet?
Now, this wasn't going to be another find, but I'm not paying the extortionate prices people charge for Ethernet cards on the Amiga. They're like over £100, or you know, like 20 of your euros. So I've bought myself, somebody's come up with a solution using an Arduino Nano and an Ethernet shield and a little bit of processing code. And then that connects to the Amiga's parallel port. So it's basically like Parnet. Do you remember that, with the Arduino doing the conversion between the parallel port signal and what then becomes the Ethernet signal, with probably Parnet or some other piece of software running on the Amiga to convert that into TCP/IP?
Have you got this working?
I haven't, no. I've only bought the parts, so that'll have to be an update. The parts, you know, you can get everything together for about £10.
Yeah. Damn, that's hardcore. I thought for a minute you were going to mention PLIP. If anybody remembers,
yes,
PLIP.
Exactly.
Connecting a computer, two computers together over the parallel port as a network.
Yeah.
I remember setting this up in the early 2000s on some really old laptop, and giant chunky heavy parallel cable, but being able to then, you know, use like Lynx, the LYNX version on this old 486 laptop.
So
those were great days.
Is basically the same version. It's like, I guess I haven't done it, but it's like PLIP on the Amiga side, but in basically the other computer is embedded in the Arduino with the Ethernet port all on the other side of it. So
that's actually not that much different to how just modern Wi-Fi works. I mean, if you take one of the Wi-Fi dongles, you'll find, essentially a microcontroller connecting to it, and probably over the UART or something like that. Serial port networking just over USB.
Yeah, well, if the Amiga serial port's really funny. And they were, in fact, a lot of the early versions of the Amiga serial port had a bug in it, which meant that spurious bytes were injected into the signal every few minutes. But I think the maximum board on there was slow anyway. I don't know if it could obviously manage MIDI, which is 3300. But it was like 1900 or something. When I'm tempted to go and get my old modems and plugging in, but this is crazy.
Where does it end?
So where was I going with that? That's it. Anyway, the Amiga thing was one of the other thing was a small find, and it's the list keys command in tmux, list-keys, list all of your key bindings, because I'm always forgetting the new ones that I've put in the configuration file. And then something not really related to Linux, but I watched the film Arrival, the sci-fi film Arrival, which is out for rental in the UK. And I didn't catch it in the cinema. It's by Denis Villeneuve, who's incidentally is directing the sequel to Blade Runner. But I must admit, I have no hope for the sequel of Blade Runner, and this has turned into a bit of a sci-fi film review thing. But after watching Arrival, there's a small sapling of hope, because I really, really enjoyed it. What's interesting about Arrival, and looking at you both, I guess you've not watched it.
Hang on, can I just ask, is Arrival the film where these aliens come in pods and start writing stuff?
That's right.
I have seen it. It's the first film I've seen at the cinema in about 2-3 years. Oh, well, yeah, I watched
I really
it
liked
recently.
It. Well,
I thought it was all right, actually, yeah.
Well, yeah.
It was okay.
Well, I think what I really liked about it was it goes against a lot of Hollywood cliche for, like, I think it's sold as like an Independence Day in a way. That's the way the trailers look. But it's actually really about a linguist trying to communicate in a way that is like the opposite of anthropomorphic, or the opposite of the way that aliens are often depicted. And of course, it fails in lots of those ways. But essentially, it was so refreshing to see a film that really took the fact that we can't even talk to dolphins, so why are we going to be able to talk to aliens? You know, took that kind of problem seriously. Or octopuses. Did you see the? In fact, there was an article the last couple of days about how intelligent octopuses are, and how their intelligence is so difficult to measure because it's so different. And in fact, I don't know if this is a spoiler, but giving it away a little bit, the aliens in Arrival look a little bit like squids or octopus. Is
yeah, you just sort of see them a bit through the clouds, don't you?
Yeah,
but.
Yeah. So that's my other kind of find. If you're looking for a film to watch, I could recommend it. It was good. I enjoyed it. I should read the book that it came from, because
I like the way I wonder what listeners are thinking. We say like, oh, can't get a Nintendo Switch because you know haven't got that time to spend, and then we talk about making parallel port network adapters for Amiga 4000.
I know.
It's like, well, okay.
I've had so much trouble with my Amiga. I can't tell you. I even bought a glue gun to fix my SCSI cable because I wasn't going to spend money on a SCSI cable. Because my CD drive in there is SCSI, and you know how those old cables, the backs of them pull off. It's horrible. And that whole termination thing, you have to have it terminated at one end of the cable, the other end of the cable. And
I mean, I'd be surprised if it's still going, although my CD32, I think it back in England, I think that still works, and that must be from about 93 or 94.
Yeah.
Absolutely, Amiga CD32, appalling build quality, terrible marketing. You know, Commodore just deserved to go down the drain after that. But for some, yeah, it still works. Maybe it's just because I've hardly ever played it because it's rubbish.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I should end this with, I think is it Pleasance? Who was the CEO of Commodore at that period? Pleasance.
That name rings a bell. That name rings a bell, yeah.
The inside story by David John Pleasance is a Kickstarter. Commodore, the inside story. He's writing a book about his time at Commodore. And I think he was at Commodore from like the early 80s and kind of spanned through all of it, working in the UK, then in Europe, and then in the US, and then back in the UK. And has, I imagine... I mean, the Commodore UK was actually profitable even when other parts of Commodore wasn't.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Like even when the US was failing or had failed, Commodore in the UK was still profitable under David Pleasance. And I think he's going to kind of write about his experience at Commodore in this Kickstarter book, which I'm looking at it now. It's got £37,000 out of a £25,000 goal. So it's already done it.
I wonder if he's going to write it on Amiga Wordworth.
Or Emacs. I mean, it came with Emacs, didn't it? There you go.
I realise that now, yeah, being older and a Unix geek. Now I remember that Micro Emacs was built into the Amiga.
Yeah, yeah. Along with Microsoft Basic.
Really?
So, yeah. The version that came with the version of Basic that came with the Amiga was Microsoft Basic, I think.
I thought I had GFA Basic, or maybe that was on my Atari ST that I melted. I melted my Atari ST. I left it in front of a fan heater when I was like 14 or something. It made all the keys wobbly, so I took them off to let it, you know, reset and cool down. And then I couldn't put any of the keys back on.
Oh, no.
That was a shame. And it was a real shame because the ST was far better built than the Amiga. Much more reliable machine. The operating system was pretty pants in comparison. But Yeah, I broke my ST with heating, whereas my Amigas just fell apart on their own.
Well, I thought my 500 is probably still working. I had to replace the floppy drive, but yeah, I mean, that's...
Yeah, 500 and 500 plus. Yeah, I remember my brother had one. They were built like tanks, but 600, 1200 onwards, you know, they're just creaking things. And that's clicking floppy drive when you didn't have a disk in there. And it kept clicking at you to put something in. That always felt painful. It always disturbed me as a child. No wonder I am the way I am now.
So
all the Amiga.
While you've been thankfully chatting, I've Googled Amiga Basic. Amiga Basic was designed and written by Microsoft.
Oh, no. Although I don't think I ever wrote anything in Amiga Basic. I did ZX Spectrum Basic, and then I did Blitz Basic on the Amiga.
Yeah, that was brilliant. Blitz Basic. Yeah, well, that was like the skid marks, and those games were written using Blitz Basic, weren't they?
Yeah, I think it was some dudes in New Zealand, and it was an insanely fast version of Basic for making games. You could just knock up sprites. It was even easier than like Pygame, but of course it all ran on the Amiga super smooth sprite handling hardware, and you could just compile everything, put it straight on a floppy disk, and give it to your mates.
Yeah, that was Blitz Basic.
Let's get this Amiga podcast going, shall we?
Yeah, I'm trying to look into it. I think Microsoft started off creating Basic to try and break, try and make software cross-platform, to try and break monopolies on hardware.
Ah, that's clever.
And it was only later they realised there was far more money to be made in actually entrenching these monopolies and crushing user freedom.
Once they passed a critical mass, or I suppose the PC, it was the PC, wasn't it? I mean, that was luck. That was the IBM PC-AT patents and people installing cheap compacts and looking for an operating system. I mean, those things happen, and that's, you know, innovation. Anyway, God, we've gone. It's because Andrew's not here to look at us sternly and remind us that his tea's nearly ready. They were our fines.
QBasic is still supported, by the way.
Yeah. QBasic,
according to Wikipedia.
I wrote a game, and I've talked about this before, but it was a very simple game. The game that times you counting different, typing different words and alphabet into the computer so it looked like I was working at the office. Had a little high school.
But it couldn't browse Reddit. No. It wasn't that.
But it looked like I was working because I was typing so much.
I'm on the Wikipedia page for for Quick Basic now, and it's got the Hello World program, and it's just Hello World. Just enclosed in quotes. Then it's got the extended version with print Hello World.
Whoa. yeah, we should have a halfway reminder now, but I think I'm just not going to do it. There are no neurons, so I think we should launch headfirst into the voice of the masses, if anybody's got that in front of them.
I'm just loading it now.
Hang on, according to Wikipedia, today, programmers sometimes use DOS emulators such as DOSBox to run QuickBasic on Linux and on modern personal computer hardware that no longer supports the compiler.
I'm sure there was a Linux version of QuickBasic or one of the...
There's FreeBasic, but it cannot... Right. According to Wikipedia, it cannot yet run all. And for some reason, all is in italics, which makes it... I don't know, it makes me feel a little bit uneasy. But all QBasic and QuickBasic programs.
Right, so maybe not Gorilla or whatever else there was at the time.
Okay, so let's... shall I read out the voice of the masses... unless you'd like to
please.
Do it. Okay, so it's the question this fortnight has been, what has been your distro path over the years? And by that we mean, we've talked before about what distribution we've started on and often what distribution we're using. But now that many of us have actually been using Linux for a long time, or even if you haven't been using Linux for a long time, it's an interesting question to see how your distribution tastes have changed over that time and perhaps, you know, where that path has taken you. And we had loads of fantastic responses. And it is indeed an interesting question, and as I'm sure, you know, the three of us will attest. But I'll start off with Andrew Bowden's the first to respond with a huge list. I first installed Linux around 1998, so it's been a long time to remember them all, but I think it went, so this is how it goes. SUSE, because it was on a magazine cover disc. Red Hat, probably for similar reasons. Mandrake. Ubuntu, a revelation. I installed an early version and stayed on it for about a decade. Linux Mint are because of Unity, I suspect. Kubuntu, because Mint moved to using long-term releases from Ubuntu. And I was mostly into KDE apps. And then Fedora, my most recent install. I moved because when I installed Kubuntu 16.10, it would just lock up on the login screen. And so that was a big journey. You can see that Ubuntu was a bit of a big shift there. Luke Walsh, I started using Mandrake 6.0 to 7.x, then went to Slackware because it just worked for me, then landed on Ubuntu years later, then to Mint. Now have Debian and Ubuntu Mate on different systems. To Skin, about 20 years ago, I started using Linux on a server OS only. Started out with Red Hat 6 and switched to Fedora. Then Raspberry Pi came out, went over to Raspbian. But nowadays, I'm switching all server stuff to CentOS Ubuntu server. LTS versions are important. Then switched everything to Manjaro because Arch seemed like an OS for me, but I wanted to try Arch first. And then moved everything over to Arch with i3 and Zubuntu as a backup OS in case Arch failed me. Very sensible. Omniferous implementer, Red Hat 5.1, Mandrake PC Linux OS since then. Wow, a long-term user of PC Linux OS. PC Linux OS, I think, was started off as like a Mandrake set of packages by Techstar for Mandrake.
Yeah, well remembered. It was, wasn't it? I didn't even know it was still going.
So Davey P, Ubuntu 8.10 to start with, then Mint when Unity first came in. Did not like Cinnamon, so tried KDE and Kubuntu. Finally found GNOME 3 as my preferred desktop, so use Corora. All the Fedora goodness and the latest GNOME versions with added codecs, etc. Ease of usage. Jonas, I started with Mint, switched to Ubuntu. Ubuntu got into Arch. Between there, a few derivatives. I switched a couple of years, but now use OpenSUSE because I want to try that out and wanted to get my NVIDIA driver finally working. I should switch to you two, really, because I'm only about a quarter of the way through some of the comments, and it actually is really interesting. I really like it.
It is. I think it's one of those voice of the masses where, you know, we can read some out, but it's just worth the worth listeners just going to the site and seeing for themselves. Although there was one guy who listed BIOS there in his list of Linux distributions, so that really did make me furrow my eyebrows, but, you know, we'll let him off. It's also interesting when you read somebody's distro path and it actually rings a bell with you. There was one that started off very similar to mine, Red Hat 5.1 from a magazine cover disc. Then I went on to SUSE for a while because I wanted Linux box sets. I only had a terrible dial-up connection, so big SUSE box sets with CDs and manuals coming through the door. It always felt like Christmas those boxes would arrive. Then I went on to Mandrake for a while. I'm not sure why. Maybe just, you know,
no, but experimenting. I remember Mandrake was like, it's about like the Ubuntu of its day. It was easy to install, and was it URPMI on Mandrake that made like installing dependencies and all that kind of stuff really, really easy?
Yeah, but that came a bit later. I for some reason I moved to Mandrake even before it had any of this, or even the graphical installer. You know, it was one of the first distros to have a good graphical installer. So I can't remember why, but and then I was actually on Slackware for about 3 or 4 years.
Why? Why did you choose Slackware after? Because isn't that kind of the opposite of
it? Yeah, and I think that's the reason. I think after being, you know, surrounded with cotton wool, and I just thought, right, I want pure, basic, down to earth, unpatched. I know what I'm doing now. I know what I want. And then I switched to, it must have been Zubuntu, and I've been on Zubuntu ever since. It's all right. It's not an absolutely mind blowing distro, but it's just reliable Debian base, slimlined interface, regular releases. You know, reasonably well supported. So that's it for me. I've got no intention to move.
How do you think your tastes have changed? I mean, what's important now is, I suppose, I don't know, what was important in the beginning and what's important now?
It's a good question. I mean, in the beginning, everything was so new. Everything was so fresh. And moving to a different distribution felt like, wow, it's a whole different world, different software's available, different configuration tools. But as time goes on and Linux gets a bit more standardized on these things, then, I don't think that it matters so much. I guess the only thing that matters to me now would be having a Debian base. I got nothing against RPM. Fedora is a brilliant distro for cutting edge, but I just know where I am in Debian. And Debian itself is fine. It's just Debian stable tends to be a bit old. So give me a Zubuntu, and I've just got everything I want.
Do you think you still...
What about you?
Well, I mean, over the years, I suppose we've talked about this quite a lot. I mean, I think it started with 5.1 on the Amiga back in the late 1997 or something like that. I just thought I'd try Linux because it was something new, and also Amiga Commodore was fading, and the hardware was old. I almost certainly had a PC as well by then. And this thing was sitting at the side of the desk, you know. Probably I had a Windows 98 on a PC and wanted to try, really liked the idea. In fact, I can remember specifically I wanted to do some programming. The ecosystem on Windows meant that not only did it cost money for me to get involved and to buy the compiler and the software, I also couldn't freely give away the software that I wanted to write, which wasn't really for altruistic reasons, but more because I didn't want what I was writing to die. I just wanted it to, you know, to contribute to something and make it feel like there was some worth in it. And I also didn't like the way that you were beholden to the way that other people thought an operating system should operate and when it should be updated. And I like the idea that with Linux, the effort that I put into learning the skills, even if I decided that I didn't want the upgrades, was still relevant. I could still put the effort in if I felt it was important enough to keep that software running.
And at the risk of going back to the Amiga again, it's not a risk because I'm going to do it, but you must have at the time, the development environments on the Amiga were insanely expensive. I remember as a kid,
Lattice C. And, you know, really? It was a bit like, yeah, I bought DevPack and I bought Lattice C. I can remember buying Lattice C one Christmas and, you know, I had a job and it was like £220, I think. Came with a proper ring-bound folder. You know, like you must have felt with those SUSE boxes. You know, opening it up and unclamping the ring, opening it up to those pages with the compiler or stuff. But the main problem with the Amiga was the speed. It was just so slow, even with an 060 compared to like a PC. And so that was obviously another thing, although I didn't really get into the programming much until a couple of years later when I finally installed Mandrake on my PC.
The richness and variety of development tools you get for free on GNU/Linux. I'll give it GNU then because so many of them are from GNU. You know, it's just mind-blowing. You wouldn't imagine going and paying for a compiler now. Even Microsoft has to give away Visual C, I think, or at least for...
And a bit of a shout-out to Trolltech and Qt. It was Qt that got me into programming. I think it was just after... It was just at the time of the QPL license, and GNOME had obviously started off to counteract what was a closed-source license at the time, but they kind of resolved it in the end. And as a toolkit, I mean, do you remember, God, we're going to talk about the Amiga a bit, but Magical User Interface, MUI, it's like the predecessor of what Qt was. It was like these widgets and everything that actually was constructed by a single person, did a really great job of upgrading the user interface. And I really liked the way that Qt did this, that you could have a web browser, you could have the sliders and the buttons and everything. And GTK did a really good job with it as well. But, you know, those early decisions have actually stayed with me. I don't use KD so much for the widgets and the way that it looks because I use so much of the terminal now. But, I found it difficult to leave. I've had periods of using OpenSUSE, I've used Ubuntu, and I have Ubuntu Neon. I have KD Neon on one of my desktops. Arch obviously is really important to what I do, which has been, I've really loved getting back down closer to the bare metal, which I think is maybe a phase in my life I'm going through. I don't know. I should probably read out some more. What do you think? Kevin O'Brien, I started with Mandrake because I heard it was easiest for people new to Linux, but when it seemed to be floundering, there was this new distro called Ubuntu. And when I found they had a KD version, that's what I wanted. I occasionally try something else, but my daily driver is Kubuntu LTS. There's a lot of people. Ubuntu is responsible for a lot of people being happy with Linux.
Yeah. Well, the presentation and marketing at the well, as well, at the time, you know, you could get a nice shiny disk delivered to your door for free with the Shipit program. They did all the right things at the right time, I think.
Yeah. And it always looks so good and installed so well. David Parker, my path so far, Slackware, my first foray into Linux. Debian, when graphics started to become a thing, we decided to install Debian in our Frankenbox, and then Debian to Gen 2. My go-to distro of choice from last year of secondary school until now. Took me about a week to do since the first one I did solo. It's been steadfast favourite ever since then. I'm sorry, I've neglected you a bit, Ben, but I just wanted to ask Mike, you obviously always used to get enjoyment from, like, because I used to tinker with Gentoo installs and stuff like that, and Slackware, obviously. And then there's MicOS. But do you still derive enjoyment from kind of doing everything yourself, or is that something that's kind of gone?
I never installed Gentoo in my life, to be honest. Oh. I've never installed Gentoo. No, that wasn't me. It must have been another Mike Saunders. But yes. The answer is yes, but at an increasingly lower level. Like when I was writing MicOS, I enjoyed working really close to the hardware, just me and the computer and the BIOS. And then just before I left the UK a few years ago, I bought a PIC chip programmer, so a microcontroller programmer and an LCD screen and a keypad. And I wanted to make my own computer completely from scratch. And I never really got round to it. All those pieces are sitting in a box somewhere. But
yeah,
a bit like the find I mentioned earlier with creating an 8-bit CPU from scratch. That's, if I go anywhere now, that's where I'll go. This way lies madness, yeah. You know, probably be like pushing electrons around when I'm in my 80s manually.
I think that's why a lot of us may use Linux, because even though we'll never get around to it, it's just that we can, you know, we've not welded ourselves to an ecosystem where it's impossible or against the law.
Yeah. You can still break down your Linux installation, your distribution into its component parts and replace them or poke around with them. Some people say that's got a bit more difficult with modern technologies like systemd and stuff, but it's still all there if you want it. Yeah.
How about you, Ben? I mean, maybe the biggest tinkerer of all of us.
I don't know about that, to be honest. I've never soldered my own graphics card.
I should send you a link. It sounds much more glamorous than it really is.
I actually started exactly the same as Mike with Red Hat. I can't remember what version. Off some magazine cover desk, I genuinely can't remember what. And then SUSE, because I wanted a box set. And I can't remember why I picked the SUSE box set now, but it came with a big fold-out thing with all the DVDs and a big stack of manuals. And yeah, and I stuck with that for quite a long time because I had the a big box full of manuals, so I knew what I was doing with it. Then that machine, what happened? Where did I go? I was on Mandrake for a while. Before Mandrake, I used Demo Linux for like 6 months to a year because I didn't have a working hard drive, and that would run entirely off the CD.
So why did you stick with it? What made you not go back to Windows?
I didn't have Windows.
nobody had Windows.
Yeah, fair enough. Now, I was at uni studying computer science, and there was nothing to use Windows for,
right,
to be honest.
Yeah.
Linux was a much better fit for my needs. It had the compilers I needed, the software I needed, you know, when we were doing stuff with like Yak and I can't even remember all the other software. It was all Linux software I needed. So
yeah,
there was no reason. I've never really been a gamer, so I didn't miss anything.
Hang on. So for a while you were using Demo Linux because your hard drive didn't work. So you were constantly booting up a live CD.
Yeah.
And when you did anything, where did you save it?
I could save stuff by SCPing it onto a server.
Wow. Respect.
The hard drive was in warranty still, actually. So I was just being lazy and hadn't posted it back.
Was it a Deskstar? Was it an IBM Deskstar?
No, it wasn't. It was a Western Digital something or other. And in the end, I posted it back. I was like, I need a new hard drive. They sent me three replacements because they sent me one. And they said they'd sent one and it never arrived. So I phoned them up or probably emailed them. I was like, you never sent me the replacement. And then that arrived like the next day. So I was like, then another one came. And I forget. Anyway, they ended up sending me three hard drives. So I packed them all in and then I just overheated and I think they all died. So I was using Mandrake for quite a long time. Yeah, because I quite got into the whole KDE thing and Mandrake was
a good KDE disk
at the time. Had all sorts of weird desktop configurations. I don't know what I'd have done if you could have had wobbly windows back then, but it would have been a horrible mess. I had a go with Gen 2, and I never managed to get X to work. And this is the sort of thing that you sort of forget thinking back, is that actually changing distro back in the day was a big thing. You had to get all the software, then installing it. It wasn't just, oh, click, 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 install. I mean, I spent probably 2 days trying to get my Xorg working with Gen 2 before giving up.
Yeah.
And you know, other distros took a long time.
Yeah. God, yeah, getting X to work. That's what. That's one of the reasons why I gave up on the Amiga, because one of them was the fact that there was no graphical interface. I had to get X to work, and I couldn't get X to work. But I can distinctly remember first encountering an RPM. Why can't I download this blob? And then if I have to change the executable bit on it, I can understand that. But then when I do that, why doesn't it run?
I remember exactly the same thing. I've been using Windows, and you know, you get an X and you double click on it and you get a little install wizard. And I was like, I don't know what to do with this. I tried clicking on it and I can't remember, probably a face full of binary data. And it was probably 6 months after I first got Linux that I actually worked out how to install anything new.
Yeah.
But it did come up with quite a lot of stuff, so yeah, I could get stuff done for 6 months. And yeah, I remember, as you guys were saying, that just suddenly having all the different compilers and interpreters and stuff that you just didn't have before. You had like maybe a Mickey Mouse version of BASIC came for free, and everything else was really expensive.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was, yeah. And after Mandrake, I went to Ubuntu because we were using that at the place I was working at the time. Gave up when Unity came. Went to using Mint in both the Mate and Cinnamon versions. And switched back to Ubuntu maybe 5 years ago. And
asking you the same question that I asked Mike, are your motivations different now for using Linux than they were? You just need something to get stuff done now.
Yeah, today I use what I can get stuff done on. I literally have the vanilla interface installed. I haven't got any tweak on anything. It is just bog standard Unity.
So you don't spend hours like me compiling TMUX and the terminal emulator to get 24-bit support?
No, in fact, I have a very small tmux.conf.
No, I use plugins, TPM plugins, and Powerline.
No,
I thought that was for Vim Powerline.
Yeah, there's a fork of Vim Power, or a re-implementation of Vim Powerline for Tmux.
Damn, sounds amazing.
It is, Mike.
Join us.
It's so cool. You should see the candy in my terminal. I mean, sitting in my KD desktop. Yeah. Okay, awesome. Oh, God, I could go on. I don't know how much to... It's late. We've gone on for a lot longer than Andrew would let us. I'll read a couple of more. Espada V8. There's a long list. I'll read the first experience. Like Ben, and also like me, was at university, a friend running Red Hat. It was just so useful for getting stuff, you know, for accessing, you know, the same kind, and then this is me talking, an approximation of what you could, the machines that they were using at university, which were almost entirely Unix. His path is Mandrake, Lindows.
Lindows, wow.
Now,
or Linspire.
Yeah. Now, one of the first interviews I did was with Michael Robertson, the guy who created Linspire Lindows. And the thing with Michael Robertson, he owned at the time, and this is probably 2004, mp3.com. And he had this dream, and he was telling me about it, that what he wants to do is for people to host their own music on mp3.com, or the fact that he hosts all the music in the world, and if a check some lines up, they get access to it immediately. And I laughed at him. I thought it was a crazy idea. The internet is too slow. It'll never work. God. Anyway, Lindo's Red Hat, SUSE, Linux from scratch, Slackware, Debian, Gentoo, and Fedora. Todoist, Cantwell, Ubuntu Elementary OS, Antigos, Ubuntu Mate, Solus. Solus is popular, isn't it?
I think that's the one with the budgie desktop environment, but I'm a bit out of the loop.
Christopher A. Winnegar says, Mum runs MicOS.
Cool, excellent. There is a video of somebody getting his mum to try MicOS on the internet, yeah.
Duncan Murray, I like this. Duncan Murray starts with Workbench 3.1.
Well, hopefully he's still using it. Does it just end there?
It goes Epoch.
It's the Scion operating system.
Oh, thanks. I didn't know what that was.
Yeah, I didn't. Scion Series 3. Yeah. Oh, this Windows guy's cool.
Windows XP, in quotes, the lost years. Ubuntu 1904, salvation. Ubuntu 9.10, I don't want Unity. Ubuntu 10.04, beyond support. Several attempts to save desktop Linux for me. Linux Mint Mate, Ubuntu GNOME, Classic, Fedora plus GNOME, Crunchbang, pretty good, but wasn't so keen on all the config. Ubuntu Mate 14.10, saved again. Ubuntu Mate 16.04, beautiful. And the last word has to rest with Darren Drapkin, who says, Slackware, several others in a flurry, Slackware again. So we leave it all as it begins with Slackware.
Good work, Mr. Volkerding. Yeah.
Right. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Ben. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll speak to you again in 2 weeks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. It's such a nice day.